little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelick, here with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julia Menten. Hey, Julia.
Hey, Bob. Today's topics include information disorder and its treatment, common techniques used for pushing lies, the use of narrative in communicating, the history and current state of journalism in America, insider tips on how a typical newsroom functions, how to best consume the news and mitigate the negative effects of social media, and a wide variety of other topics.
And we are so excited to have as our guest a person with the most interesting and diverse background, I might say, of any of our guests so far. And a broad brushstroke would describe her as a medical doctor who graduated from the University of Cambridge, an Emmy Award-winning journalist who got that education at the University of Toronto, as well as a poet and author of books on a diverse number of topics, including the one that brings her to Thinking Clearly, titled What the Fact? Finding Truth in All the Noise. Dr. Seema Yasmin is a professor at Stanford University of Medicine and at the Anderson School of Management at UCLA. She's investigated disease outbreaks for the CDC, worked as a CNN medical analyst, and held a fellowship in journalism at Stanford University, where she investigated the spread of health misinformation and disinformation during public health crises. And that's the short list of her many accomplishments. Dr. Yasmin, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here. I think we'll just dive right in. As Bob mentioned, you have a really interesting and diverse background that, you know, fits well with our show, the topics we've covered. Maybe we can start with a little brief backstory highlighting what brought you to your various careers and interests. And I'm also really curious, how did you get from finishing your medical degree at Cambridge to what you're doing today?
Yeah, so I started off working as a hospital doctor in London and really loved clinical care and patient contact, but was seeing every single day the impact of misinformation and disinformation. And this was like over a decade ago, seeing how it impacted patient beliefs and therefore impacted their behaviors. And then even within the context of the British medical system, I was seeing that we weren't always providing the most holistic kind of care. So I'll give you an example. We had a lot of patients who were injecting drug users, who were homeless, for example, and they might come in with an infection caused by injecting drugs. And it felt very often, too often, sadly, that we were draining an abscess and giving antibiotics and clearing up an infection and then just sending people on their way out of the hospital. And I can't even say sending them home, because many of them, literally, I lived in the same neighborhood and I would walk past them sleeping on park benches as I walked home. And so I started to get frustrated with the way we were practicing medicine. We weren't really dealing with the root causes of why people got sick. I'd come into the ED and see the same names on the whiteboard day after day or week after week. And one day they'd come in for an infection caused by an injection. And then the next time they'd come in with HIV or Hep C. And it was something that felt like such a failure to them that we should have been preventing them becoming much more chronically ill. And so I'd spoken to a mentor of mine, Dr. Lynn Paxton, who'd had a long and storied career at the CDC. And she asked me if I'd heard of this thing called the Epidemic Intelligence Service, which is a very unique program within the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention here in the US, and also a partly part of the military through the US Public Health Service. And she did say to me that it would give me a very solid foundational training in public health, investigating outbreaks, but also understanding root causes of why people or even entire communities get sick. Because it's part of the military, EIS doesn't let in too many non-Americans each year, but she and others were very supportive. And so I came to the US over a decade ago to serve as an officer in the Epidemic Intelligence Service. It was really a dream job. It was 2011, the same year that the movie Contagion came out, in which Kate Winslet plays an epidemic Epidemic Intelligence Service Officer, obviously the very Hollywood version of it. And so I was really excited to do that job for so many reasons, partly because I'd just gone from having 20 or 30 patients in a day in a busy East London hospital to now serving entire communities, perhaps even looking at outbreaks that were happening in an entire county in the US. And so that felt really satisfying. But what happened is very early on, as an Epidemic Intelligence Service Officer, I saw that we were very focused on following the steps for contagion control, following the steps to stop a pathogen on its path to destruction through a community. And actually, one of our biggest foes, if you like, wasn't just the pathogen, it was all the misinformation and disinformation about disease, about the public health system, about government workers, about the government, about science. And so I felt really ill-equipped to handle that. And also what happened during my time as an EIS officer is I thought I'd be like Kate Winslet, minus the, you know, the death. Sorry, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen Contagion, but minus the all of that. I thought I'd be dealing with a lot more novel or exotic pathogens. And actually, what became the bane of my life as an EIS officer in the US were vaccine preventable diseases. And I kid you not, but American children suffering and even dying from infections that could have been prevented with a vaccine. And that felt like the ultimate failure. And I felt that we were not well trained, were not adequately prepared to deal with the anti-science, anti-health, anti-government misinformation and disinformation that was actually unraveling decades of progress in public health. What good were these incredibly safe and effective life-saving vaccines if they were in freezers and not in the children? What good was that? What good was a public health system if we were failing children and kids in the US were dying of flu and of pertussis and other diseases? And so that's what led me to journalism school.
You were perfectly primed for what happened in 2019 and continued up through today. Had all the right experience and interest. So right at the start here, I can't help but pan for a few nuggets from your wealth of experience about communicable diseases. So based on your work at the CDC, Stanford University, and elsewhere, and your experiences later on with the COVID-19 pandemic, give us the most important takeaways that might help us respond quicker and better to the next pandemic when it arises.
Yeah, and the thing is that there will be another one. And, you know, for all the epidemiologists out there who were thinking that we were at the 100-year anniversary of the Spanish flu outbreak, you know, we're very aware that there will be more outbreaks and that there will be bigger epidemics and bigger pandemics. And I feel like we failed the public in so many ways with COVID. There's a long list of things that I think we could do differently. I think one of the most important ones, though, is actually going back to early childhood and developing critical thinking skills in people so that when there's a crisis of any kind, a natural disaster, I mean, epidemics are natural disasters, but whatever that crisis might be, it always will occur in parallel with an infodemic, meaning an epidemic of information. And that could be accurate information, but it's also often misinformation and disinformation. And so what happens during that crisis is people need answers and they are just deluged with information and find it really hard, we all do, find it really hard to separate what's accurate from what's inaccurate, find it really hard to separate what's helpful and useful information from what's unhelpful and not useful information. And we do people a disservice when we leave them flailing at times of crisis during times of emergency. And so we have to start really young in equipping people with the tools for critical thinking so that when that crisis happens, as it will many times during our lives, they are prepared and understand how to pass through information, that they can be aware of the information ecosystem that they live in. I would say that's broadly really important. And then what we saw fail during COVID was it was very apparent about the lack of scientific literacy, so that even when people were being good scientists, they were misunderstood and therefore mistrusted. I'll give you an example of that. Early in, I want to say March 2020, forgive me if I'm a little bit off, but there was a time when Dr. Anthony Fauci was saying to us that we didn't need to wear a mask to prevent contraction of this new infection. He was going off the best available data at that time. And then very shortly after, he said, no, that's changed. And here are instructions on how to make a cloth mask at home. And this, again, was a decision based on the best available evidence at that time. He was looking east to Asia and seeing the information and the data that was coming from there based on countries that had instituted masking. And he was comparing morbidity and mortality data from those different countries. What I heard from many people, some close to me as well, was this scientist, supposedly the top scientist in America, is flip-flopping. He's changed his mind. How is that a good scientist? And I thought, that's so unfair to people that we've left them with that interpretation, as opposed to having primed them to understand the scientific process. Because that reaction of Tony Fauci's not knowing what to do or changing his mind really showed us that people were not scientifically literate, and that if we had properly trained people in scientific literacy and said, look, science is not a bunch of facts, science is not static information, science isn't just textbooks, and said to them, actually, science is a process. It's a process of asking a really interesting question and then testing that question, testing that hypothesis, and doing so with an open mind and changing your mind. As a scientist, you have to change your mind based on the best available data. Then people would have had the reaction that scientists did, which was, oh, Tony Fauci is a solid scientist because he is changing his mind. He's going back on what he said based on new data. So I think those two things are really critically important. Developing critical thinking at a national level and understanding that it's a national security tool, and then specifically in the context of public health crises, developing scientific literacy so that we are not trying to play catch up, which is just impossible at the height of a very frightening public health crisis.
That brings to mind so many thoughts as you're talking about that. I remember back during the very start of the COVID-19 crisis, it must have been back in 2020, that my opinion was we would have a common enemy and that this crisis would bring us together. You remember that, Julia? You know, I was so hopeful and optimistic. This will reduce the amount of political polarization and separation that we had in the country politically. And I was totally wrong about that. Whoops. So thank you for the commercial for what we talk about all the time in this show is critical thinking, science literacy, and that it's very important to start an early education with that. Can you think of things in the medical profession and epidemiology that could have been done differently or that we learned from during the pandemic? For example, you do mention in your book computer modeling to model epidemiological spread of disease, and that can also be used to understand the spread of disinformation. Can you talk just a couple minutes about that?
Yeah, sure. And that, you know, there's so many things that we've learned. Some things we did really, really well, and I'll talk about those too, because it's not all bad news. And then things we could have done better. But I just want to respond to a point you made, Bob, about that feeling, especially looking back, that this awful thing happened to us and it affected every single human on the planet. Why wasn't it that unifying human experience that actually brought us together? Why wasn't it human versus virus? And that's one way it could have looked. It could have been like, wow, this is a really terrible thing. How do we band together to take care of each other and to really take care of the most vulnerable, the neighbor who has the kid with leukemia, right? Like, why wasn't it that? And I think there's so many reasons for that, and people will point to societal and structural issues, and I think there are definitely factors there. I want to pinpoint another factor that speaks to our conversation, and that is that I think we were manipulated. I think we were manipulated by bad actors so that the pandemic became a mass polarizing event. And I say this because we do have solid evidence about how outside groups, especially some hotbeds for seeding disinformation from Russia, jumped on the pandemic as they had jumped on other things. And so I talk about this in What the Fact, that if we can keep an eye out for this, if we can understand how disinformation is engineered, then we can be really savvy and not be so vulnerable in falling for it. And so I think that's what happened, is that we had these bad actors who want to seed disunity and polarization and destabilize the US. And what they do is they research us really well, and they say, oh, what are the things that keep Americans up at night? Oh, maybe race issues, maybe gender issues, maybe it's feminism. And so we've seen these analyses of how they have gone in on the Women's March that happened a few years back, how they've tried to use the Black Lives Matter movement to then seed disinformation. They're very content agnostic. They don't really care what they see disinformation about, as long as it's the thing that's going to rile us up. And so they do that really well. And whether it's manipulating an election, whether it's saying, ah, this virus has come along, now let's really use some of the anti-vaccine sentiments to rile people up, they're just very, very effective at doing that.
And a good moment to define our terms, as we like to revisit here on Thinking Clearly. You mentioned misinformation and disinformation, which we've brought up a few times. Misinformation, of course, being the sort of accidental sharing of bad or false information, and disinformation being what you're talking about, the intentional proliferation of bad information or misleading information.
I think it's helpful just to have, like, it's almost like diagnostic language. Like, it's sometimes helpful to call a thing what it is and have the words to do that, to just separate things out. Maybe the impact isn't always that different, whether it's misinformation that spreads through your community or disinformation. But I do break down these terms even further under the umbrella of information disorder in the book, What the Fact, just so that we're all on the same page and know what we're talking about. And then to answer the rest of Bob's question about lessons learned, I think we failed in terms of preparation. So, for example, we had depleted the strategic national stockpile of N95 respirators in the US after the H1N1 flu pandemic. Now, you might be looking back to 2010, 2011, and thinking, well, I don't really remember a pandemic back then. But technically, that was a pandemic. It may not have been as globally disruptive as COVID was in 2020 onwards, but we did have mass spread of H1N1 influenza around that time, 2010, 2011. We keep a strategic national stockpile for emergencies like that. That's why it's there. We didn't replenish the N95 stockpile after H1N1. And so when COVID happened, it's partly why Tony Fauci was saying, here's instructions on how to sew a cloth mask at home. It felt very 1940s, as opposed to just go out and buy N95s, because we had a nationwide shortage and we needed the first responders to have whatever sparse amount of those N95s there were. And I had friends who worked in the ED wearing DIY masks to work, the mask that they used at home when they were spray painting a door or something. It just felt really, really unprepared, criminally so, you know, like it just didn't need to be that way. I think also we saw that CDC failed us in doing something that it often does really, really well, which is developing tests for novel pathogens. It just got things wrong in that process, and that really set us back. We also saw a big lesson learned, and not necessarily a surprising one, but how geopolitics and poor diplomacy will impact people's health. People literally died and got sick because there was a delay of information sharing between the nations earliest hit by COVID and those watching the waves spread towards them. You can't necessarily fix that in an instance. You need long-standing, good, positive diplomacy. And so we saw the impact of that lack of transparency in certain countries trying to protect their reputations. Again, not new. There's another coronavirus that hit us a few years earlier, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS. And we saw that with some nations like Saudi back then, they were hiding how many cases there were, which is really unhelpful in the context of, you know, a disease that doesn't care about borders and doesn't care about your government's reputation or about economic plans or any of that stuff. So we just need really good data sharing at those times, and we saw some of that really fail us. I'll end by saying that what was fantastic, I think, is that we did see the most rapid development of a vaccine in human history. Prior to COVID hitting us, the fastest we had ever developed a vaccine was about 10 years, and that was for mumps. So the speed with which we did it for COVID is really proof of what happens when we do come together. We form international scientific alliances. We pool our money. We also have done the prep work before COVID happened so that we're ready for something like this. And we just need to plug in the final genetic recipe for the virus to output a vaccine that's really effective. And so we ended up with multiple vaccines that were safe in record time. Two things I'd say about that is one, please can we now do the same for HIV and malaria and dengue and these other viruses that have been plaguing us for so long? And then the other thing is that, or with malaria being a parasite, of course, but you get my idea. Like, can we apply this same idea of all of us pooling together and banding together resources to accelerate scientific development? But then, of course, the issue is, yes, we have this really exciting, rapid development of safe and effective vaccines for COVID. What use is that if there was also so much distrust in the scientific process, so much misunderstanding about, well, how is it safe if it was developed that quickly? We weren't doing a good enough job of catching people up with the scientific process, to my earlier point, and that could have saved lives and could have built trust at a time when we really needed that.
It was quite a time. It's all coming back to me, the many years. You had mentioned your book, which I have to commend you. It's a very entertaining and catchy title that kind of gets to the point. What the Fact, Finding Truth in All the Noise, kind of makes me think of being a kid and trying to see through the snow on the TV and decrypt what's going on behind the scene. But maybe you could tell us a little bit about your book, What the Fact, Finding Truth in All the Noise, kind of an overview of what the book covers and what kind of effect you hope it has on its readers.
I'm so glad to hear that you enjoyed it, Julia. I really wanted to write it to be a page turner. Doesn't feel like a textbook. It tells stories and it uses stories to educate you without you kind of realizing it. And let me tell you the motivation for writing the book. The motivation for writing the book was partly the January 6th insurrection and my publisher being like, oh my gosh, we're going to have more events like this if we're not giving young people the tools to see when they're being manipulated, if we're not giving young people the tools early on to think for themselves, to read between the lines, to understand when someone's trying to persuade them in a bad direction. And of course, I live in this world of studying misinformation and disinformation, but it can so often feel just like negative, like doom and gloom, like, oh my gosh, this is so bad. And actually, there are solutions for it. You know, I totally agree if somebody wants to say that, quote unquote, fake news is the problem of our age because it filters through to everything, to democracy, elections, climate change, gun control, right? The environment, everything can be impacted by misinformation and disinformation. But I'm also really hopeful and evidence-based because I see the people doing incredible work that can protect our brains, especially if we start young, but it's never too late, protect our brains from being persuaded easily by poor information. And so, What the Fact is really a guide, like a navigation guide, a how-to guide to our modern world, to understanding what misinformation and disinformation are, what they look like, how you might come across them, how you might be duped by them. And it really shows that everyone, no matter how smart or logical or rational or scientific you think you are, we're all vulnerable to falling for lies because they are engineered to be really, really compelling and memorable and believable lies. And also, this isn't a new problem. It's age old. I think we kind of get stuck in this like, oh, it's all social media. It's all the internet. It's all so bad right now. Actually, we've had these problems for as long as we've had humans. There have been quack doctors trying to sell snake oil. There's always been people lying, trying to push an agenda. We just actually now have really good modern day tools that are evidence-based for saying, okay, we've lived with this problem for so long that there are now actually proven ways that you can build up your, what we call, quote unquote, your mental immunity to falling for lies, to falling for persuasion, so that you can be really savvy. You can take a second, you can pass the information and be like, okay, no, this is credible, this is solid, or this seems suspect. My red flags are, waving, the alarm bells are going off because I read this book and it told me to look out for this, this, and this. And so that's why I wanted to write the book. I felt really sad that young people were just being told, like, watch out for fake news. Don't believe anything you read, see, or hear, which is a really terrible way to move through the world, just being like skeptical of absolutely everything, as opposed to saying to young people, hey, there's a ton of information circulating out there. Here's a guide on how to stay sane, how to curate your own news diet, how to use social media in a healthy way. It's not going away. We don't have to throw it all out. And here's a way for you to be like a really savvy consumer of information so that you can make up your own mind about things and not be so easily swayed by people.
I found the book to be a very accessible and comprehensive introduction to the state of our current information environment, the role of news sources, social media, algorithms designed to capture our attention in this information economy, political polarization, which we've talked a lot about on this show, how our beliefs interweave with our sense of identity. You cover heuristics and biases, as we have on Thinking Clearly many times, and many of the other topics that we've covered in the various episodes of Thinking Clearly. But I use the word accessible because of your rich use of narrative in the book, no doubt coming from your experience as a journalist. Can you tell folks a little bit about the use of narratives, the strengths of narratives, how it engages users, and maybe some of the drawbacks of using narratives in situations where people are actually trying to think critically about things?
Yeah, and one way of looking at this is just to think of the last time you saw some communication headed your way from a scientific agency or a public health institution. Just think about what that looked like. Do you even remember it? And then compare it to the last time you saw a piece of like something that turned out to be misinformation or disinformation. Maybe somebody saying something that is not true, like vaccines cause autism, and that's how their child became autistic. One of those has accurate information behind it. One of those is really boring, and it's usually the information that's coming from the public health agency or the scientific institution, because what happens is we have historically just relied on facts. Let me hit you over the head with bullet points. Here's a pamphlet. Here's a PowerPoint. Here are the facts. It's all scientifically solid and proven. And boom, 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 here are facts. Human brain isn't really well engineered to absorb a million data points, or a study that happened in Denmark with a million kids who had the MMR vaccine and they were all fine and they all lived to adulthood. That's actually not as interesting as the way the data, the untruthful data, is presented by those who might be saying, lifting their toddler up to the camera in a viral YouTube video, saying, my child used to be able to string a sentence together and now they've regressed and it happened the same week that I gave them the MMR vaccine. And the mother's crying and the kid's crying and it's all very emotional and sad. And you're like, oh my gosh, I mean, if the mother's saying that the child's regressing, that part at least is true. And that's really concerning and really sad. But the way that story is packaged to make certain things seem correlated or even causal, it's dishonest, but it's using story, it's telling a narrative, it's manipulating emotion, and it's so much more effective than the let me hit you over the head with these 16 facts about the ingredients in the vaccine, and they're all five syllables long, but they're all safe, and we just don't absorb that information in the same way. And so, part of my work, and I'm very critical of the way that CDC and the World Health Organization have done things, and I'm a former CDC employee, but now I go back and as an outsider, I do trainings for them on how to actually take a page out of the scientific disinformation playbook. We have data behind us. That's great. We're going to be honest. But actually, can we tell stories with that data? Can we actually engage people? Because for decades, communication scholars have been studying scientists and the way that we communicate. And we don't really pay much attention, many of us, to what they've been documenting, but they've been documenting all the things that don't work. And what they've said is that we tend to default to this model of science communication that's called the knowledge deficit model. And what that looks like is, hey, community, there's a new vaccine out. I am the expert and I need to tell you about this vaccine because it's new and you don't know about it yet. There's a knowledge deficit, right? And I'm going to fill that knowledge gap with information. And what the communication scholars have been studying us, what they're saying is, it doesn't really work. There are deficits to the knowledge deficit model in that it's not effective at dealing with people's biases, which we all have. And actually, the higher your educational level, the deeper and stronger your biases are. So confirmation bias, similar, there's so many different types of biases. Actually, what they are telling us is narrative and story are much more effective at getting through those biases. They might stand a chance versus just hitting people over the head with facts. So I explain this in What the Fact. And I even, it's like you said, it's accessible, it's written for smart teens, but lots of adults have really found it useful as well. I've been hearing from them too, so that's great. But what I do is I kind of reverse engineer the way that a lie is manufactured to be memorable. And then I talk about the way that a story works, why our brains are wired very well to receive stories, and how that can be really good if you're using truthful information and you're trying to package it so that people remember it. But we need to watch out for that too, because then stories could be used to manipulate us, as we've seen with the spread of misinformation and disinformation.
So I wonder about maybe using a hybrid model, and maybe that's what you did in your book, engaging people with the stories to get them hooked in, to get them to experience it in human terms, and then throw in some of the information, the data, the resources. People look further beyond the headlines. When I hear narratives, I immediately think of, yes, that person is telling a story to illustrate something that happened, because it's pushing their agenda. But what is the statistical probability of that happening? How many times does that happen? Because sometimes people come up with stories to motivate and trigger other people to get the troops riled up about a situation that happens to foster more political polarization. And what I want to think about immediately is, yes, but maybe that has happened, but it might be a statistical anomaly. The degree to which it happens may not warrant getting upset about it.
I mean, we pay to be emotionally manipulated, right? Like, here's my $15, maybe it's like $20 to go to the cinema these days. I want to go on an emotional roller coaster. And we love masterful storytelling. We love the Nolans and all these amazing screenwriters. And but I think an interesting thing happens once someone peels back the curtain on that process is that you just have a slightly heightened awareness of what's happening. And I think that can just make you a tiny bit more vigilant, not hyper vigilant, not uncomfortably skeptical and moving through life in that way, but just aware of the power of narrative, just reminded that, oh yeah, of course, as babies, we learned cultural norms through storytelling. Like, that's so natural to us. And so I think there's a power there in the same way that in the social media chapter in What the Fact, I'm not saying, oh my gosh, it's all terrible. The algorithms are just purely evil, like throw everything out. There's some of that because, there's evidence to show what's happening there. But it's just that reminder. And I found that so helpful too in writing that chapter that, hey, every time your phone pings and every time you get an alert, a notification, a like, a follower, a DM, you're getting a little release of dopamine in your brain, and it feels kind of nice. It's like when you've had a mouthful of ramen or you've hit a button on a slot machine. And the algorithms and the engineers behind these are designing it this way because they've studied our brain biology and they know how to capture us. I just find that really helpful to have that awareness, whether it's about narrative, whether it's about social media and the pings and the dopamine. I think it can just make us a little more aware and understanding what's happening to us or why it might be that some days I'm just really hooked to my Instagram timeline. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And so I really did not want the book to be doom and gloom. And I don't think it is. I'm told it's not overwhelming, but actually you get to the end and you're like, okay, I kind of see things for what they are now. And I feel like I have a toolkit. I feel like I'm kind of armed with these skills and these strategies that people have researched. And so they're evidence-based. That means I can sort out the facts from the fiction, and I can understand the power of story, and maybe I can like use that myself. And I am noticing that when I'm invited now to train at CDC and WHO, there's more and more a feeling of people being receptive to this idea. I am one of them, so I understand that when I was going in earlier, there were people bristling at this idea that we'd use story, because story just sounds so anecdotal. And it's not what we do as epidemiologists. We look at millions of data points. I'm just seeing that people understand now that I'm not saying use the anecdote that's an outlier. No, construct anecdotes and stories based on what the data is telling you.
A key concept in your book is information disorder, something apparently we're experiencing worldwide. How would you describe information disorder? And then also, kind of as a follow-up, can you talk about the five techniques for pushing lives, abbreviated as FLICC?
Sure. So the way that I think about information disorder is it's this umbrella term under which we put misinformation and disinformation, which you really nicely defined, Julia. And then also malinformation goes under there too. And actually, malinformation is an interesting one. It's accurate information that perhaps should never have been shared, should never have been public. And it's shared with malice. It's shared with the intention of causing chaos and causing harm. So it's really good, I think, to have language to say, ah, there's this thing spreading, that's misinfo, or like, oh, this is really disinformation. It's so deliberate. People know it's fake and they're still sharing it. But you put them under this umbrella because often information disorder in general just has a very similar impact of seeding distrust, of causing chaos, of causing people to be very confused and not knowing what to believe. That can feel really doom and gloom because it can feel like, oh, there's just all this stuff circulating. We have no hope of getting on top of it. And that's why What the Fact is very optimistic and very solutions oriented and completely focused on evidence-based solutions to the spread of false info. And so one of the strategies I talk about is FLICC, FLICC, this idea that was invented by this fantastic scientist called John Cook. And he was also building on the work of others as well. But I highly recommend looking up John Cook. You can just put in a search engine his name and then FLICC. And there's all this, the blogs and videos that he's created. And I talk about FLICC or the FLICC strategies in What the Fact, because what each of those strategies is a method used by people to manipulate us. So I'll tell you what each letter stands for. F is false or fake experts, people who are wheeled out that look like they have a white coat on and they have the right credentials. And actually, their lie, their facade of credibility is just being used to dupe us and draw us in. Then you have the L of FLICC, which is logical fallacies, and that can really be so many things. And in a way, all the other letters of FLICC are actually logical fallacies, but we keep that L there just so that we remember that that's one of the strategies used to dupe us. The I of FLICC is impossible expectations. So that's, for example, when someone says, oh, there's this new vaccine out, I don't trust it. And you respond and you're like, oh no, but there's all this data and they like tested it in this many ways and they had these many trials and it's safe and effective. And the person basically is asking you for 100% certainty. So if you came out and were like, oh, there's 99.3% effective, which is like amazing. And they're like, oh, I would need it to be like 99.5% or 100%. And so they just even keep moving the goalposts, and you can never give them information that completely satisfies them, which is unrealistic in a world that, let's admit it, is full of uncertainty. And then you have the two C's of FLICC. One stands for cherry picking, and one stands for conspiracy theories. So cherry picking data is when someone is looking for information that only backs up what they already think. They are not willing to take in that information that refutes their worldview. And I'm sure we've all had conversations where this comes up. And then conspiracy theories are, of course, those theories that we see spreading all the time that are also part of these strategies that are used to manipulate us, to dupe us. What I do in What the Fact, I talk about Flick, but I also talk about the disinformation playbook, and I talk about the steps used to create and concoct and spread a very believable, lovely lie. And then I talk about the fact that it's not new. It's been used for a really long time. You can go back to the days of Big Tobacco saying that our cigarettes don't cause cancer. They use the same strategies being used by bad actors now to say COVID isn't real or climate change is a hoax. So I think it's interesting and helpful to see that, okay, these folks keep wheeling out the same strategies. They're clearly very effective strategies because we keep falling for them. Can we build up this mental immunity by being aware of the ways we're being manipulated?
Yeah, you had mentioned John Cook, definitely a friend of the podcast. We had him on in 2020, actually, to talk about his game, something I'm really fond of, the Cranky Uncle, a kind of a fun game that helps people talk with the quote unquote proverbial cranky uncle who's a science denialist and climate change denier. We've also talked with Melanie Tracek King, who really helps people kind of be in the shoes of creators of disinformation and misinformation. You have a really great fun game called Bad News Game. And maybe you can tell folks a little bit about that getbadnews.com and how that relates to this topic.
None of those games are mine. I'm big fans of these games, though, because I think they're really clever at helping us see our vulnerabilities and understanding how lies are spread, how they're engineered, and how they're spread. The Bad News Game came out of a group of researchers, primarily at Cambridge University, and they're using this idea of inoculation theory, which I'm sure has been mentioned many times on the podcast. And inoculation theory has been around since the 60s. There was a social psychologist at Harvard called Bill McGuire, and he was really worried about the Korean War at the time and American prisoners of war in Korea who didn't want to come back to the US when they were released. And he was like, what is happening in their minds? They've clearly been persuaded. How do we protect people against being persuaded when they're being lied to? And so Bill McGuire came up with this idea of inoculation theory, which is, what if you give someone a heads up that false information is headed their way? So before they are inundated, before they are just a sitting duck for fake news, you tell them, hey, friend, you know something, like we're in the middle of this pandemic, right? And you know they're studying and working really hard to develop COVID vaccines, right? Well, let me tell you something. The vaccines look like they're going to be coming out soon. They're being tested really well. You're going to hear that they were developed way too quickly to be safe. And so the person you're telling that to hasn't heard it yet, but you're saying to them, you're going to hear this. It's like striking an alarm and saying, like, bad information incoming, incoming. And what Maguire and many others since then have studied is that by giving that heads up and by helping someone develop counter arguments, you give them protection so that when they are exposed to tons of that false information, they're like, oh, wait, no, I was told I was going to hear this, right? It makes sense that people would be spreading this false information right now, but I already have six counter arguments in my mind about why that's not true. And it's actually analogous to vaccines, ironically. So, for example, when you get vaccinated for a pathogen, your body is just given exposure to a tiny piece of that pathogen, not the whole thing often. Tiny piece of that pathogen. So your immune system's like, oh, what do we have here? Okay, let's study up and let's get ready so that once we are exposed to the entire pathogen and lots of it, because someone just coughed in our face, we know how to respond. So it's that same argument. And the great thing about things like the Cranky Uncle game and the Bad News game, which I highly recommend playing, is that people, the scientists who develop them and others, study how much they protect us from falling for lies. And so you actually have this data that playing these games has this evidence behind it that it protects you from falling for false information. I think that's fantastic, and we need more of that. And they just happen to be really fun to play.
I will put a link to the Bad News Game on our Facebook page when we put our podcast version of this episode up. For me, reading the book, that chapter 3 was very, very interesting because I've always been interested in news gathering. And we did one episode, we called it Behind the Headlines, and we had a news person from our local area as a guest. It's always so fascinating because people are so hooked into news nowadays. So I found chapter 3 of your book to be really interesting. It's by far the longest chapter, and it tells how the sausage is made in the newsroom, gives the organization about the newsroom, and a lot of things that I think would be very interesting for people to know. So could you just give us a little information that might be kind of just a little teaser about some of the interesting things about the news and how the news is made and how the newsroom is organized? I understand that you are doing some research on news deserts. Talk a little bit about that.
I think the takeaway from that chapter is let's do away with the idea that journalism has ever been perfect and has ever been free of bias. I'm trained as a journalist and I cut my teeth as a local journalist, so I have a lot of respect and I can even give you the data on like why local journalism can be really good for a democracy, but it's never been perfect. The newspapers of early America, of the colonies, were often created to be sensationalist. They wanted to move copy, so sometimes that's what happened. And so without spoiling it too much, that chapter takes you on this whirlwind journey of how American journalism has evolved over the years and how we got to where we are now with clickbait. And sure, we have the internet now. They didn't have that when they had the colonies here, but they were still trying to do something similar, which was grab attention and shift copies, right? And that's really what clickbait is about. So I talk about that. Then I also talk about how a news story is constructed, because I think we're often screaming into the void or screaming at people like, subscribe to your local newspaper. You should trust journalism. Journalism is really important for a healthy, functioning democracy. Yes, of course it is. But can we show people like how agenda setting and gatekeeping works and how we make decisions about what ends up in the news and what doesn't? Or can we have honest conversations about how the LA Times back in the day supported the incarceration of Japanese Americans in prisons and internment camps? Can we talk about how National Geographic said that people with darker skin had lower IQs? Like, that's also the history of American journalism. And actually, it might sound like, oh, those things happened so long ago, but just recently, we had the New York Times editorial board apologize for the way that they mischaracterized Black mothers during the crack epidemic, right? And so there's been harm done by journalism. Even for people like me during COVID, when I'm like, oh, there's a really good explainer in the New York Times about how the vaccines are safe. I understand that for some people, those are not trustworthy outlets, or that American journalism in general doesn't feel like it adequately or accurately represents the people it's supposed to serve. And that's why we've had the Kansas City Star and the LA Times and the New York Times and National Geographic and other outlets apologize for the way that they've either erased entire communities or misrepresented certain communities. And I think it's really important to talk about that and talk about that history of journalism. And then also talk about the thing that I study now, which is America's growing news deserts. We are losing thousands of newspapers. We have lost thousands of local newspapers. And what we've learned from the research is that when a town loses its local newspaper, because you're losing those people that will sit for hours listening very attentively in a city hall meeting, or we're losing those people whose job it is to really dig into how the local police department is spending your tax dollars, what happens when a town loses its local newspaper is that measures of government corruption increase, government efficiency decreases, taxes on average go up $85 per person per year, the bonds and the loans that a municipality will take out in order to build a bridge or build a hospital, the terms and the interest rates on those loans worsen. And also what happens when a town loses its local newspaper is fewer people turn out to vote. Fewer people stand for a particular open elected position, and measures of social cohesion and polarization worsen. So we know that news deserts, these areas that lack robust, good local news, are bad for democracy, are bad for governance. What I study now is what is the impact on health if a place loses its local news, not just a newspaper, but perhaps a solid local radio station too. So there's a lot to take in there, but that chapter kind of takes you on that journey of where we've been, where we are now, and why American journalism looks the way it does.
Do you have any ideas on how we can put the bloom back into these deserts? Is there something that we could lobby for in terms of government policy or, I don't know, philanthropy, something to put a little rain on these deserts?
We need new business models for journalism, that's for sure. And we're seeing some of what you mentioned. We're seeing some philanthropic or foundation-supported journalism. We're seeing citizen journalism, which I love. People doing or popping up these community-based endeavors in news deserts. But I think it might look different in different places, different countries for sure. It's not like America is the only place having this problem, but in the US, I think it might look different in different communities. And I really like for it to feel and be community led so that there is, from the foundation, a trust in the news gathering and dissemination process. I think we fail when we create news that just doesn't relate to the people that it's supposed to relate to and doesn't serve them adequately.
With all this discussion of news consumption and how we access the news and our news sources, maybe you could help guide us, give us some suggestions in the best ways to consume news and to engage with it.
I go into this in What the Fact again, because it's that very solutions oriented. And my best advice for how you consume news is to do it with intention. Because without us realizing it, we are just constantly scrolling, constantly inundating. There's this data from a couple years ago that shows like the average American, I'm blanking on the exact age group, but just say like 14 to 40 or something, spends like 10 hours consuming information. And that sounds unrealistic, except it's the way they calculate it is because we're often second screening, meaning the TV's on and we're scrolling a timeline and maybe the radio's like it's a lot of information intake and it's often not deliberate and it's often passive. So the advice I give in What the Fact is be deliberate about when you take in information, curate your news diet, think about where you might get your news on climate change versus where you might get your information and your news on the NBA, for example, or the WNBA. And by doing that, you can actually do away with that feeling of like, oh my gosh, there's just so much information. It's not a nice feeling. And by being intentional and deliberate and curating where you're going to get your news from, what you're going to read on a Sunday morning, what times of day you're going to look at the news, maybe not in bed when you're doom scrolling, that can go a long way to making you more informed, but not feeling overwhelmed by the amount of news that's out there.
In your book, you mention the idea of not removing feelings and emotions from critical thinking, but instead adding critical feeling to our critical thinking toolkit. Let's explore that idea a little bit. How would that work?
Well, all of what we're talking about is emotional. We don't take in news as robots. We take in news as humans who have reactions. And often what we're told is, oh, take all the feeling out of it. We're talking about critical thinking. And so, hard facts is what we're based on. But actually, I go back to a teaching from Confucius, the Chinese philosopher from 500 or so BC, who said, wheresoever you go, go with all your heart. And actually, what Confucius is talking about is using your feelings as a guide. And I think that can be really helpful because one of the ways we are often manipulated and one of the ways that we're lied to in a very compelling manner is by having our emotions triggered. Information is engineered to provoke a reaction from you. And the research shows you are much more likely to hit retweet, to comment, I am disgusted by this. I can't believe, how on earth? And actually, if you are more aware of your feelings, if you bring your feelings in and you're like, oh, wait, I just got really riled up, that can be such a helpful way for you to think, aha, something was engineered to provoke that reaction in me. Let me apply that emotion to my critical thinking. Why did I just get angry? Why? And so it's talking about not being super emotional, but not trying to artificially divorce your emotions from your thinking. The two are interlinked. And if you're deliberate about it, as the book describes, you can use your feelings as a guide to being a really savvy critical thinker.
It seems to me that if we do it when we're conversing with other people in a manner that brings critical thinking into it, that we can use it as a signpost if we see someone else getting triggered and maybe even ask some questions. And this is kind of a counseling technique. I have background in counseling, but you could almost say something like, it seems like what we're talking about is really getting to you or triggering you or bringing up some feelings in you, and address it, that emotion, and bring it right into a communication with that other person. And that leads into kind of the last question that I think we have time for in this really interesting episode. And that is, you talk in your book about communicating with one another and improving our civil dialogue with one another. Can you give us some of your thoughts on that?
I was in my 30s when I realized there are people whose entire careers, whose entire life work is teaching us how to have good conflict. Not to be conflict avoidant, because that's not helpful either. I highly recommend this book called High Conflict by Amanda Ripley. And I reference it in What the Fact and just make it condensed and really accessible. Because guess what? There's a science and an art to having good disagreements, to having actually productive disagreements that get you somewhere, as opposed to just butting heads with someone and getting irritated. And so I was like, we need to be teaching this to people when they're like 9 years old. Like, why are we not studying this and teaching it to younger people? And so What the Fact even has scripts in it on how to have a contentious conversation with somebody who believes the polar opposite of you, because that is the world we live in. We're going to disagree. And I mean, I don't want to live in a, like a heavily toxically polarized world, but I don't need everyone to believe everything that I believe, but I do want to have the tools that I can engage in debate with someone who disagrees with me and actually learn from them and really understand them and where they come from, as opposed to just, no, you're wrong, I'm right. And actually going back to the whole story thing, the research shows that pouring facts onto a polarized and contentious debate is like pouring kerosene onto a fire. It doesn't get you anywhere. The flames burn brighter. And so actually What the Fact talks about, how can you have a solid disagreement? How can you stand to have some hope of changing someone's mind? And of course, that always starts with you. And how can you be a critical thinker and an open-minded person?
Those are some wonderful thoughts as we approach what seems like it's going to be a very contentious presidential election coming up in November. Dr. Seema Yasmin, I want to thank you so much for sharing your stories and experience with us, for writing this very comprehensive book that we've been discussing, titled What the Fact? Finding the Truth in All the Noise. And we haven't really mentioned your other books on a wide variety of topics, but we're going to put a link to those on our Facebook page, along with your personal webpage at SeemaYasmin.com. That's SeemaYasmin.com. And to your Stanford University faculty page. Are there any other links that you'd like us to include?
SeemaYasmin.com also has a link to a teaching guide that we made for What the Fact that has chapter summaries and exercises for kind of delving deeper and bringing exercises from the book to life. So please check that out and share that with educators.
Great. And thanks so much to our listeners for your support. And as always, Julia, thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
And until next time, keep thinking
clearly.